Let's face it, once the college football season starts, nobody really wants an off date, do they? Just get Ohio State playing football every single week. Oh, apparently Burnham wants one. All right, well, I guess I was going to say, if there's a time to have one for the Buckeyes, this might be a good week for it. You can go to the pumpkin patch. You can go to Disney World. If you're Burnham, you can do a lot of yard work and check off that honey-do list. I guess it is a good weekend for that.
Yeah, but I'd rather go to a football game. I just got to try to find one to go to. But we'll see. I haven't even looked. Do the Toledo Rockets play at home this week? I don't know. Maybe I'll go to a Rockets game on Saturday because I'd like to be there just to, oh, they play at Washington State for some reason. So never mind.
You can make that trip out.
Not going to Pullman, Washington, but it's a good weekend for Ohio State to get an off week. That's for sure. Lots of, necessary rest coming for some guys. A lot of opportunities for the staff to look at ways to get better and even have the number one team in the country get better, which, as good as they played, as clean as they played, there certainly are areas to improve upon. And next week, you've got a big one. Even though Penn State stinks, it's still Penn State. It's going to be a tussle. So it's nice to have a little break before then.
Gosh, I didn't even think about the value of an off week or a second off week for Ohio State. I was just thinking about how it applied to you and me and the Austin and Berm show. So selfish of me, and I apologize for that, America. Welcome to a Freaky Friday. It is a mailbag version, and normally we get to this point of the year. Sometimes the off weeks, line up perfectly for first half and second half, and we can break some midseason bold peas down. Do you have one that's immediately on your mind before we get into the mailbag?
Jeremiah Smith is going to end up with 100 catches on the season. So it's not that big of a bold pee, but he's at, 49 grabs right now through 7 games. If he doesn't get to 100, something went wrong.
Are you counting the postseason then?
Yes, of course.
Okay. I think, as I mentioned earlier in the week, I'm buying that Julian Sand will win the Heisman, and his numbers are historically great, not just for a first-year starting quarterback, but any starting quarterback in college football. Completing 80% of your passes is pretty crazy town banana pants, and I think it's going to get increasingly difficult.
Should I increase the spice of that pepper and just say that Jeremiah Smith will end up breaking Ohio State's single season catches record this season?
That sounds better. Now you're getting somewhere.
Which is, right. I mean, I don't know. I think it's like 109 or something. So he's got some work to do.
That would be a lot. But again, if this team is going to play 16 times, there's going to be a lot of records in this. The Ohio State, Jerry Emig, as he heads into retirement, he's going to have to do like 2 months of work updating the stats book and the media guide before he heads down that old dusty trail. But we have a ton of questions. I think Berm picked out 6, 7, maybe 8 of the best that we could get into. And let's waste no time. Let's dive in on this Friday on the beat. Thanks for following along with us all season, by the way, on 97.1 The Fan, 10TV, 10TV Plus. And if you've got the audio only, you get that anywhere you've got the podcast. So you know that if you're watching or listening, but you have all those other options available to you. And if you're listening, you can't see that the first mailbag question is, what are your favorite plays of the season so far? What comes to mind for you, Berm?
I think it's kind of a weird one in retrospect because it really wasn't a big play. Didn't really lead to anything for Ohio State. It was against Texas. It was Julian Sain in the end zone, rolling out under duress, finding Carnell Tate on the sideline, throwing an absolute dart out of the end zone on the run. And that was one of those moments where I fully acknowledge that I was in wait and see mode with Julian to see if everything that we thought he might be because of his recruiting profile and all the hype around him coming from Alabama was going to live up to the expectation. And that was one of those moments where you're like, okay, this dude has some stuff to him. And that throw, you know, we've seen it multiple times this season since, that rolling out to his right and just throwing a dart on the sideline. And then, of course, Carnell doing what he does, maybe the best sideline catch guy in the country. And I don't mean that necessarily just in college. He's incredible at making sure that he gets his feet in and bringing in the football. So that was one of those plays where where I was looking for a little bit of proof of life from the Julian Sain experience, and that was it. So I know it sounds like a inconsequential play, but to me, that's one of those moments that stands out.
Yeah, I didn't want it to be too recent. I this season has gone like crazy fast, in my opinion. Like, feels like Texas was 7 or 8 months ago at this point. And even like those tune-up games against Grambling and Ohio, like, it's like, do I even remember what happened? And I was like, oh yeah, remember when Caleb Downs lined up on the line of scrimmage and then dropped into coverage and then just snatched an interception out of midair? And that was the early, I don't know, sign to me about what Matt Patricia was cooking up, what he could do with someone with Caleb Downs' skill set. He was already doing with Arvell Reese. We saw that in week one. You could name, I think, 15 plays from Arvell that are just like otherworldly. And I don't think we need to rehash all that. But I think even if it was against Grambling, that was a wrinkle that I don't know that we ever would have seen from Jim Knowles. And I feel like this week I've maybe, you know, picked on him and used too much hindsight, not properly. I fully appreciate what Jim Knowles did for Ohio State for 3 years and the national championship and the top ranked defense a year ago. But one thing that defense really wasn't, I think, was all that creative. I remember going to Jim Knowles' first chalk talk at the Ohio State Coaches Clinic. And it was, he put up all these clips from Oklahoma State, and it was, here's all the different coverages that you can disguise and all the different variations of this defense that you can run and fool and deceive opponents. And it's like, I'm a simple man, and I'm not an X's and O's savant. I'm not even like an X's and O's competent individual.
What's like a step below savant on the list of things?
I'm not an aficionado of X's and O's. I've never made, that's not been the hallmark of your coverage or my coverage. We make it well known that the personalities and telling stories for me is what really gets me into it. I try my best to ask questions and understand what they're doing. But even for me, if it was like, I feel like there's not a ton of creativity or variation from week to week with what Ohio State was doing under Jim Knowles. And that was fine because it was good enough for them to win a national championship. This year became like a new experience and a new challenge to try and figure out what they were going to do from week to week and what personnel groupings were going to be involved. And I still can't diagram it for you, but I know that I'm having a really good time watching it. And the Caleb Downs pick, I think, was that time where it was like, you know what? I am going to learn a lot this year.
Yeah. If I had to pick a runner-up, close runner-up, it's probably the Jeremiah Smith touchdown on the 3rd and 11 from the 17-yard line at Washington. That's one of those moments where Ohio State, like, it seems at times this year they're trying to fight with one hand behind their back on offense. And that was like a reminder play. Like, we can just do this whenever we want. And in that game, down 3-0, 2 minutes to go in the half, it was not a game, even when you're down 3-0, that you feel like you're in trouble or like you're on the verge of losing. But it was still a play where you, like, you always have that trump card if you're Ohio State, because you have Jeremiah Smith and Carnell Tate. And in that situation, 3rd and 11, to just be like, oh, ho-hum, we're going to throw a little tunnel screen to Jeremiah, and it's easy, and no one can stop it. That was another one of those moments for me. So I could also probably pick like the Caden sack in that game against Damon Williams in the third quarter. That game had a couple of those plays. But ultimately for me, it was game one verification of Julian saying that I think I personally needed to see so that I could go into this season and not be like all melancholy about things.
Negative burn.
Right. Exactly. No one likes that.
Guess my runner-up or my offensive pick would be Carnell Tate's touchdown last weekend at Wisconsin, the opener there. Everything about it. And then the fact that Ryan Day was like practically giddy and excited to go talk about all the other details about him moving to slot. And I think Julian Sayin's pocket presence and sliding to the left to get enough time for Carnell Tate to finish the double move and then get the football, put in a spot where only Carnell could catch it with two defenders coming to collide with him and high point the football and then have his helmet ripped off. It was like from start to finish, like there was something at multiple positions that you know, Quincy Porter's out there on the outside. It's like so much that was new and exciting, and the catch was as good as you're ever going to see. And I really feel good for Carnell. The way that the first 7 games have gone, he's not just making these plays because Jeremiah Smith exists. It's helpful because he's getting some opportunities that he might not be afforded if he was, I don't know, to pick an example, the primary target at Oregon. That the year might not be working out the exact same way for him. But people are noticing, as you mentioned, with the toe tapping and the sideline work, how elite of a wide receiver he is every week, because he's making catches that very few humans can.
Yep. He's pretty good. It's a good season. That play was just awesome. I mean, from start to finish. So perfect football.
Yeah. And the guy who was integral in the recruitment of both Jeremiah Smith and Carnell Tate and
Brandon. What's a word that means more than integral?
Vital, imperative.
Yeah. Wouldn't have happened without him.
Yeah. Impossible. Without Brian Hartline, we did spend this question came in. It was about so much talk about Brian Hartline calling plays going into the season. How has he done? It seems like wide receiver U is doing fine with him as the offensive coordinator. Yeah, more than fine. They're still very good. I personally, Berm, I feel like I have to just say incomplete still on this grade. And I know that the question is direct. Like, how has he done so far? I would say he's done fine. And that's not sexy or exciting analysis, but you know, sort of by Ryan Day's own admission, they haven't, not just the pace of play, but even like depth of number of pages into the playbook that Ohio State has gotten. They've not dipped that far into the water of offensive football. Now, the aerial attack looked awesome at Wisconsin, and that's maybe been specific to the running game that they haven't done all that much. But until they get to that point, it's still a little bit of an unknown about what that will look like.
Yeah, I mean, I just don't think we are smart enough to know really at this point. Again, you look at last Saturday's game against Wisconsin, for example, the first drive of the game, Ohio State runs the ball one time. It's a negative 1 yard. You throw it eight times for 95 and it's a touchdown. And it's the simplest thing in the world for Julian Sain and the Buckeyes to do. They feel like a team that can do that whenever they want to, but they obviously know that they need to find balance. They know they need to be better in the run game. The run game has been lacking innovation. It has lacked creativity. It has at times lacked execution. There's been all these shifts happening to the personnel. Everything kind of looks wonky. You lost Chip Kelly and Justin Fry, and the run game coordination is under construction. You have three new offensive line coaches all teaching different things at times. I just think that it's a really hard thing to quantify how he's doing as a play caller. But primarily when you're running 45, 46 plays a game, I don't know how deep in your bag you get. But then on the other side, you don't have to get that deep in your bag because you have more talent than everyone and you're suffocating everybody with your defense. And so the offense doesn't have to do a whole lot. I feel like it's been okay, but I also know that Brian Hartline has exceedingly high expectations for himself. Ryan Day and the offense have a standard that they believe that they have to reach each and every play. And so I would imagine that there's been some push and pull from Ryan and Brian in at moments. But when I look at the execution, when I look at like the run game and the inefficiencies in it, I don't know that I can place that on Brian Hartline on his shoulders, because I just don't know enough about the operation behind the scenes to determine what's to blame. Now, if Brian Hartline is carte blanche to call whatever he wants, and there are these problems that exist in practice and these plays are not working in practice and they're still being called in the game, fine, we can really, you know, question the decision making there. But I don't know enough about it to say that that's occurring. I think it's clear that the run game still lacks some explosion and lacks some creativity, but again, I don't know if Ryan Hartline's responsible for that, or these are the 14 run plays and you just got to call them when you need to call them. So that is something I wish we could really get a little bit more insight into with the way that the media schedule has been this year. We've only spoken to Hartline once. That was on the first off week of the season back in September. I doubt we'll talk to him again until the bowl games season. So I don't know that we're going to get the answers that we want there. I will say there are times in games when it feels like the Buckeyes are not using all of their weapons that they have at their disposal. And I don't, if Brian Hartline's the one that's in charge of that, then I would say that's a problem. But I don't know that he is.
Well, let's go back to what the offseason conversation was actually like then, when Brian Hartline is getting promoted to this play calling role. He's going to be the true unquestioned offensive coordinator and the last voice on the headset for Ohio State. Well, as they completed the staff, the one thing that Ryan Day clearly knew he needed, and that Brian Hartline was going to need some assistance with, was the run game coordination, which is how Tyler Bowen emerged as the pick to be the offensive line coach and replace Justin Fry. Was that his previous experience as a coordinator and his knowledge of the run game was supposed to be a nice complement to that. So again, as you said, we're not in the headset and we're definitely not in the offensive game planning meetings. And I'm not bringing up Tyler Bowen's name to blame him for whatever deficiencies, perceived or real, exist for the run game. I just don't think that we've seen a full bore, 100% intent on getting something done version of the Ohio State rushing attack yet. And I also understand the counter argument to what I just said. Is like, well, don't you think you should work on that during the course of the year? Like, why are you just banging your head against the wall or running into heavy personnel and 13 tight ends over and over, or seeing some of the same run schemes in the past that we know Ohio State hasn't had all that much success with? And I would say that's a fine point. You can also not scheme up an explosive play and still execute at such a high level that you generate them because you have better players. I don't want to paint a picture that everything is super rosy and you have to have a little faith that once they try, they'll get it done. I understand that some skepticism is warranted at this point. There's a 7-game sample size and that explosiveness hasn't been there. I do still believe that it will come. And part of that is because of the personnel that they're working through. And part of it is still inexperience with all of these running backs. Maybe there have been times that it has been blocked up better. It was suggested to me earlier in the week that there had been some cutback opportunities that were missed. And that applies to all four running backs. CJ Donaldson is new to the system. James Peoples is new to being a full-time back. That hadn't worked out. Bo Jackson is a true freshman, and Isaiah West is a true freshman. Like, they're gonna not execute perfectly. It's not supposed to work that way.
Yeah, and ultimately, the truth is, every play can be an explosive play when you have players like Ohio State. If you have a list of plays and you're like, well, these are the ones that can only get us 2 yards if they work perfectly, throw all those plays away. That's stupid.
Yeah, you don't need those. Those are
like,
dumb.
That's dumb. Like, get rid of those plays. The idea that you have to call or dial up explosive plays, I just don't buy. Like, every play at a place like Ohio State, if it's executed correctly, should have the opportunity to go for a big play. That's why you draw them up. So we're through enough of this season to know, based on this personnel, based on this execution, what works and what doesn't. So let's get rid of the stuff that doesn't and go from there.
Yeah, no, I think that's fair. But again, that's why I'd say it's incomplete, because, you know, to truly give, if they win a national championship with this version of the offense, which is entirely possible, throwing it 42 times and having Julian Sand complete 36, still going to be tough for most teams to stop that. And I know that Brian Hartline and Ryan Day both want more balance, but this team doesn't have to go 50-50. And in fact, it's probably not designed to do that.
No, and I know the argument. I hear the argument. I make the argument. Like, you need to be prepared for whatever happens on November 29th in Ann Arbor with the weather. Maybe you can't throw it 42 times. Every game you play after that, you can. And those are the ones that win you a national championship. So, like, there is some part of me that's like, screw it. Just, you know, do what you do best. Like, go ahead.
I know that no one will want to hear that. Because I think you mentioned this a couple of weeks ago. You feel like Ryan Day is trying to build a team that is both simultaneously equipped to win with a passing attack in neutral site in perfect weather conditions in a playoff, and also be able to win in Ann Arbor in late November. They definitely have one of those. I'm not certain about the other.
Yeah, I would say I'm closer to certain that they don't have the other one right now. But that's right now. There's still five games left before you get to that moment. So plenty of time to get things worked out. But overall, with Hartline as the play caller itself, I think it has to be an incomplete grade, because we just simply don't know enough about the operation and who's in charge of what. But, and I don't know that enough deference has been paid to the changes, like the losing Chip Kelly, losing Justin Fry, losing Quinshell Judkins, losing Travion Henderson, losing three offensive linemen. Like, this is stuff that takes time to sort out. And Ohio State and its fan base, myself included, is not traditionally known for being patient.
Well, plus they're 7-0 and number one in the country anyway. So we immediately fast forward in that situation.
The problems are always there.
The issues are always there, to the nitpicking. Personnel with the run game is something that I think they've got to get sorted out. And you said they've got four opportunities to do so before they go to the Big House. The question came in, can Ohio State actually play four running backs? To me, the answer is no.
I mean, can they play four running backs? Sure. does that mean you're going to get the best out of those four running backs or the best out of any one of those four running backs? That to me seems like a pretty firm no. I think you need to start paring it down. I think you need to find your bell cow and lean on your best players. I think everyone has a role they can play. I really like James Peoples out of the backfield, catching the ball and doing stuff like that. We've seen him make some impact in that way. I like what CJ Donaldson does in short yardage. I think that there's an opportunity there for him to make plays. But for the majority of the time, it looks to me like Bo Jackson is the best running back on the team, and he needs to be the one getting the carries. So if everything you've done to this point is building toward your best version of yourself, then the best version of yourself can't be dividing the carries amongst guys that are not breaking tackles, not getting more than 2 or 3 yards a pop. So time to start narrowing the focus.
Yeah, I certainly agree with the idea that there are roles for all four of them. And if you had a team that averaged 100 snaps a game, it'd be pretty easy to unleash all of them. James Peoples is probably the best suited to do some creative things as a receiver out of the backfield. CJ Donaldson is definitely a guy that Ohio State continues to have a lot of faith in short yardage and red zone situations. Bo Jackson is deserving of being the lead running back and having the complete package at his disposal. And Isaiah West is showing that he's got, you know, some juice and some electricity to him that can spark this attack. And, you know, if they all had a chance to get 10 touches for an Ohio State rushing attack, I bet they would all be productive in some form or fashion. Yeah. But in that hypothetical scenario, that's 40 plays, and Ohio State is pretty clearly intent on playing 60 or so. And that would only leave 20 for Jeremiah Smith and Carnell Tate and Max Clair and Brandon Ennis or Will Kazmarek or whoever else. And that's just simply not enough. So I'm trying to do the math, and the Austin and Berm show is not a math show. To me, it just isn't mathing to do that with four backs. And you and I have covered and talked to running backs, you know, at Ohio State specifically, you know, for 14 years now. They all will tell you that they want to get into a rhythm. They want to, you know, get into the flow of the game. They need to see what a defense is doing. They need to take a couple hits. They need to figure out how to attack teams, and that takes carries and that takes time on the field. Now, maybe that's self-serving in some respects because they want the football and they want those opportunities, but I tend to give them the benefit of the doubt that there is you will get better and more productive if you do have an understanding of that speed of the game. So as we sit here right now, I would think that has to be an opportunity that Bo Jackson gets first. Isaiah West is putting himself in contention to be second in line. Maybe that's premature. Maybe that's recency bias. I don't know. We'll see when November starts. But CJ Donaldson is definitely still going to have a role for this team. So I don't even really like it when they get to three, personally, especially given the number of snaps that this team plays.
Yeah, especially because we saw the recipe with two guys last year and how it can work. James Peoples had opportunities early in the season to make some plays, and he made an impact, and he, you know, made people excited for his potential in the future. But when it came down to it, the last 12 games of last year, it was just two guys. And I understand, as I've said repeatedly in the last 2 weeks, like Isaiah West and Bo Jackson are not Quinshon and Trevion, but they're closer than the other guys are. And I think you need to be prepared to narrow that down. I also want to go back in time. 95 is the most catches in a season by an Ohio State Buckeye, and that was Jackson Smith and Jigbo. So Jeremiah Smith at 49 right now feels like that's a cakewalk. So
that was really bothering you, huh?
Yeah, I was like looking it up. Like, wait a second, that didn't feel right. That number was that. So that's going to be easy.
Yeah, anyway. I think there's no question that he's going to get to that. So can they? Yes. Should they? I am pretty staunchly in the no camp for running backs. Big picture, zooming out, Ohio State is 7-0, and I saw a very stupid show. Everyone who's followed the Austin and Berm show for any length of time knows how much I hate the Tuesday night college football playoff show on ESPN and the selection committee creating arguments nonsensically. On Tuesday night, they did a version 2 weeks before the first selection committee show that was just using the AP poll as a projected. And I thought,
totally normal, totally necessary.
Please turn this off of my television, because Ohio State was number one, of course. And the question is, what are the ideal playoff scenarios for Ohio State? I think they're pretty limited in that they want to win. They want to beat Michigan, obviously. They want to win the Big Ten, and that will send them to the Rose Bowl. There's a couple things that Ryan Day, I think, needs to check off the resume. Needs maybe too strong a word for someone with a national championship. Certainly wants to. It would certainly enhance if he can get a couple of those, you know, monkeys off the back. But then if you secure that, and I think a lot of people, I still get questions about this as well. It's like, well, where would Ohio State go? Do they get to pick geographically? Is it their preference under this format still? The top four seeds will be allocated to where the conference tie-ins traditionally would go. So if Ohio State wins the Big Ten, like I think they will, the ideal scenario is get used to it, the Rose Bowl. That's not ideal for me. I don't want to go there. It's not my favorite. But the path ahead of them then would be, in all likelihood, the Rose Bowl in the quarterfinal and the Fiesta Bowl in the semifinal. And I'll definitely sign up for a trip to Camelback for that second round. But as that bracket was set up right now, Berm, the 8 and 9 currently would be Ole Miss and Miami. And I definitely think Ohio State would sign up for that.
I don't know that you want Miami in your first playoff game, but I guess you're gonna have to go through them eventually.
You are worried about Carson Beck against Matt Patricia?
I like Miami's defense quite a bit. I like their front four quite a bit. I like the way that they get after the quarterback quite a bit. I believe Mario Cristobal has proven time and time again he will find a way to not get there. So I don't want to worry that much about that right now. But my entire approach to this sort of thing is just get there, and then it doesn't really matter. Like, you're going to have to play the teams you're going to have to play. Obviously, in an ideal scenario, which is what this question's asking, you'd want the first game off. You don't want to have to play four games in the playoff if you can avoid it. But on the other side of that coin is all the teams that had an off week last time lost in their first game in the playoff. So maybe you get that momentum going, and it's easier to maintain as opposed to having a week off where you had to sit back and rest.
But some of those teams just sucked, and they shouldn't have been in the top four anyway.
Well, there were some very bad teams out there last year. Let's be clear. Not very bad. They made the playoff, but they did not belong really in the conversation. And in an objective, like, selection committee, they are a subjective one as opposed to objective. They would not have been picked, like, period. Like SMU, for example, they would not have been picked. Or Indiana last year, they would not have been picked, despite the fact that they were good enough to be there. I don't know. I look at it more from, like, who do you not want to play? You know, who are the teams you don't want to play? So the way I watch Ohio State, the way I see the rest of the country right now, Alabama's one that I think would be a real tussle for Ohio State. And Miami is one I think would be a real tussle for Ohio State today. So, I understand your point about Carson Beck, and you can force him into some mistakes, but Miami's defense can also put you into a blender if you let them. So I don't really care. I'd love to not go back to the Rose Bowl because I don't really like it. But other than that, just get there and, you know, what is the old Semper Fi saying? You know, end them all and let God sort them out. That's the way, you know, get there and figure it out. Like, you have to win no matter what. You have to beat who you got to beat.
I don't think that's what Semper Fi means.
I know it's a Marine saying.
So. Yeah. Avoiding the Rose Bowl means losing
either in November or.
I mean, probably not at the end of November. I mean, I think Ohio State will probably be in a situation where it can still lose a game and make the Big Ten championship based on the way that the standings are shaking out. And
yeah, but I mean, if you lose to Indiana in the Big Ten championship game, Indiana goes to the Rose Bowl.
Well, that's what it comes down to. The Big Ten championship game will determine whether. Now, they wouldn't fall out entirely, so there is a possibility that you could have an off week if it's Ohio State and Indiana, and right now that's a 1-2 scenario. Then the loser is not going to drop out of the top four the way they would a year ago. They have changed that part of the format, so maybe Berm. The solution is you just win the game in the Big House. Then you opt out of the Big Ten championship game against Indiana. You let Indiana go to the Rose Bowl, and we don't have to go to LA.
Sounds good to me.
Okay. That's the ideal.
I don't think anyone's going to opt out. This team, these dudes at Ohio State want that Big Ten championship ring.
Gosh darn it. All right, then we're going to the Rose Bowl again. Who is a player who could change the public perception of themselves come January 19th after the national championship game?
That's an interesting question. Who needs to change the public perception of themselves?
Oh, well, right now, the players that would be in line to help themselves the most would be someone like a resurgent Tegra Tshabola. I think now Max is on an upswing, but I think there was a suspicion that he would be a one and done player at Ohio State. I don't think that he has done enough to warrant that. He could have a dominant playoff run that changes the conversation. Let's see who else could do that. It's kind of a relatively short list because I think most people around the country already think, and certainly NFL talent evaluators think very highly of Ohio State's roster. So there may not be a ton of actual like upward mobility that you wouldn't normally expect.
You know, one guy who's coming to mind for me, because it's kind of what happened last year in the playoff run for Ohio State with Cody Simon, is Sonny Styles, because I think he's sort of becoming a forgotten man in this current defensive alignment because of what other guys are doing, because of the attention Arvell Reese is getting. Sonny, I mean, he's still, like, I've seen him ranked as the number 5 off-ball linebacker in the upcoming draft, but that's 4 spots behind Arvell Reese, for example, who is now listed as the number 1 ranked off-ball linebacker prospect in the draft. So I think Sonny's a guy, if you get into the playoff and you let him sort of do the things that Cody did a year ago, you can open some eyes and change some perceptions, because I believe that nationally the idea is that Sonny's like the safe linebacker. He's the unathletic one, which is super stupid to say. So I think if you give him a chance in the playoff to cut some stuff loose, maybe he's a guy that could reshape the narrative around what he's capable of. Davis and Ibanosin, maybe.
I guess we maybe missed the obvious one, because this has not really been a regular conversation for us, but I certainly am aware that it is out there, that and I've got questions about it at Letterman Row as well, that like, why is Brandon Ennis still playing for this team? He's not producing enough at wide receiver. He has mishandled punts. He fumbled one that was costly and put Ohio State in a hole when they started the Big Ten slate. And it's not like I'm trying to tune that out, but I just, like, every time that you're in the Woody, the conversation about Brandon Ennis is off the charts, and not just because he's a captain, not just because of the work ethic, all the things that we've pointed to throughout the offseason, but, you know, willingness to do the dirty work that not everybody wants to put in at wide receiver. He showed what he could do again at the end of the Wisconsin game. That catch was pretty darn good, and maybe that'll be a turning point for him where you get to, you know, week 7, and then the opportunities start building, and maybe he makes a huge play at some point in the playoff. That absolutely would not shock me in any way, shape, or form. I don't think in this, and I understand, and I'm one of them, I've been talking about Mylon Graham for a long time. You're seeing Quincy Porter make some plays and flashing. Ryan Day talked about him during his lightning round on Tuesday. I certainly understand the impetus to want to see those guys play more snaps, but I don't really think that I'm in a world where I think they have to come at the expense of Brandon Ennis. And I think there's going to be games, and maybe it would be January 18th or 19th or whatever day it actually is, where he just makes a play and you go, ha, that's why they stuck with that guy.
Yeah, I could see that as well. Like you said, I mean, maybe Davis and Igbenosin's in that conversation just because nationally everyone kind of wrote him off a year ago after the penalty problems. If he was on a national stage against like the best of the best wide receivers in the country and able to do what he's done through the first 7 games of this year, I think that would put him in some different conversations. But it is a short list, as you mentioned.
Yeah. All right. We got time for one more before we get out of here for this off week weekend. I know that this came from my guy Sully. If you could relive a game you've covered, what would it be?
Either the 2016 Michigan game, the double overtime Curtis Samuel game, just because it was just such a unbelievable experience in Ohio Stadium, or the 2014 Sugar Bowl against Alabama, which was because that was like the national championship that year, regardless of what we had to do a week later in Dallas against Oregon. But the Alabama game, that seeing those two programs collide in that space, in that atmosphere with all the talent that was on the field that day, like that, and then the play, you know, Zeke threw 85 yards through the heart of the South, like being on the field for that play is one of those moments that when I'm getting ready to shuffle off this mortal coil, I'll be like, that was pretty cool. I saw that, you know, like that was standing next to basically Eddie George and Kirk Herbstreit and all those former Buckeyes as that play happened. And then you see like what I like moments like that, because those are especially guys like Kirk Herbstreit, who's one of the more objective, almost to a fault, almost to the degree that he sounds like he hates Ohio State in some cases. Seeing that love for the Buckeyes like couldn't be contained in that moment was pretty cool.
Yeah, I think probably not in Columbus, but nationally when you have the conversations of, and I remember one of those just doofus lists last year about the best games of the college football playoff era, because the championship was not actually on the line, that Sugar Bowl matchup with Alabama tends to kind of be lost to history in some respects. It was the first playoff. I'll never forget it. You won't ever forget it. Cardale's not ever going to forget it. Steve Miller's not going to forget it. Mike Thomas isn't going to forget it. Evan Spencer's going to, like, there were more great stories than I could have ever hoped to tell and write. And it's one reason I'd like to redo it now. I'd like to be able to take this version of the Austin and Berm show and snap judgments in the notebook and apply that to that game. We didn't have those resources available to us at that time. We weren't doing daily podcasts. We certainly hadn't broached the idea of the notebook. Can you imagine what the notebook would have been like at the Sugar Bowl that night? It would have been, I remember just walking around outside the locker room. Darren Lee's on a golf cart with his defensive MVP, and like Tom Herman, you know, some of the stories that they were telling about this game. And as you mentioned, like Ohio State knew once they beat Alabama, there was not going to be any issue against Oregon. And it was sort of like the vibes of, I told this story, I think earlier in a mailbag this year about the notebook after the Cotton Bowl against Texas was, I think, the best one that, or the most memorable to me. I don't know if it was the best. I hope people agree that they enjoyed it. But like doing that after the Ohio State Alabama game would have been that times like 100. Like,
yeah, I guess like looking back, I wish I could redo that one, because I went into the photo workroom like 40 seconds before the Evan Spencer to Mike Thomas touchdown, and I missed that one on the field. And I kind of wish I would have not done that, but I was in my infancy as a photographer and was like, yeah, nothing's going to happen here. And whoops.
Well,
so, lesson learned.
That wasn't a team that had a ton of momentum. They had to have a play like that to generate it. But I think maybe that's obvious, but that's the one. If I could go back and help some officials at some point, I would do that for the 2019 Fiesta Bowl.
But yeah, maybe that's one. If this question is the outcome is going to be the same, then the two games I mentioned are probably the ones I pick. If I could go back and have the game just played again, and like not knowing the outcome, the 2019 Clemson game would be one, and the 2015 Michigan State game, because that was just an absolute aberration that nobody should have. I mean, nobody should have to experience that, but you know, I would like if that one could be redone, because that was those two teams from Ohio State, the 2015 team, the 2019 team, are probably even more so than last year's team, the most talented teams in this century for Ohio State, and neither of them won a national championship. So,
yeah, that 2017 matchup with Penn State and the comeback for JT Barrett, like we never talk about it anymore because what happened the next week, but in the moment that was one of the more bananas comebacks and impressive individual performances that I can recall. Remarkable stuff. I think, you know, Johnny Dixon making a couple plays, if I'm not mistaken, late in that game. Marcus Ball with a touchdown. Like
And JT Barrett, after 4 years of being at Ohio State, 5 years, 6 years, however long he was there, going out and playing like a perfect fourth quarter in a game that nobody saw coming, and a guy that everyone thought was not good at throwing the football. Like when he had a moment and just got to let it rip, he was flawless. That game was awesome.
Yeah.
Remember that? Like Saquon Barkley returned the open kickoff for a touchdown. Ohio State was down, what, 38 to 17 in that game? Something just absurd.
It was crazy. The details are a blur to me because it's just like, well, this game is over. And then JT went to superhuman level, one that he'd never reached before. And guess I'd have to relive it because I know I wrote a column that night. I'll never forget it, where they said that Ohio State would be building a statue for him and he was going to be getting on a Heisman in a few weeks. And then his first throw the very next week, I was like, I need to probably delete this from the internet.
It was 35 to 20. Penn State with 7 minutes to go in the third quarter and 38 to 27 Penn State with 5 minutes to go in the game.
That's James Franklin for you.
Ohio State like doesn't have those types of games almost ever. So when you need a comeback like that, and then you actually get one, like in that moment in the horseshoe, the Sam Hubbard play, like the whole thing was just the all gray wolf gray uniforms. Like it was just a very cool game.
I don't want those back, by the way. It was impossible.
Seven banks blocking that field, blocking the punt. Just a cool game.
Yeah, couldn't read the numbers, so that made it very difficult to cover from the press box. But it was fun anyway, and it was fun to walk back down memory lane for some of those great games because we are very fortunate to be able to do what we do and be at every Ohio State game and covering it. And it's a weird weekend when we don't have one, but we'll be back at it next week. Of course, I will not be on Monday's Boren Blitz as you plan ahead for Penn State week. That's going to be up to Berm.
It'll be the Borman Blitz.
That's see, I don't incorporate my name into it. I just call it the Boren Blitz.
I'm an eagle,
but
a fool.
You can do whatever you want with it because I'll be traveling back from my off weekend number two experience with the family. Hope all of you have a fantastic second off week. Get ready because this stretch ahead, starting at the beginning of November with Penn State coming to town and the 5 weeks of the regular season and what I assume will be a trip to Indianapolis for the Big Ten Championship, it's going to go fast. So make sure you're rested, recharged, and ready. I know Berm's got to get healthy too.
And I don't assume anything.
Okay, good. That's what bold predictions are, an assumption in some ways, but we didn't do that many of them. We'll do that next Friday when we get back here. And thanks again to everybody for following along. Hope you have an awesome weekend. The Beat will be back all next week. Snap Judgments will be back. Normal schedule as we get ready for Ohio State and Penn State, which is a big noon kickoff on Fox. Until Monday, I am Austin Ward. He's Jeremy Birmingham. We'll see you later.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams 4th of July sale and get 30% off paints and stains June 26th through July 6th. Whether you're refreshing your interior or exterior, we've got the colors to bring your vision to life. And with delivery, getting everything to your door is easier than ever. Shop online to have it delivered or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only, some exclusions apply. See store for details. Delivery available on qualifying orders.